Thank you so much for coming, and I hope you're starting to settle into your practice so far this session this morning. It's really, I started by thanking the people who organized and set everything up here, but also it's I want to thank all of you for making the time to give yourself this this session, this retreat. It's really good that we can come together, really gather ourselves together, both as a group and individually, just gather all the different parts of our lives together so we can come to session and bring some benefit to our lives. And it's no small thing because, as you know, this is a Mahayana practice. And so we practice deeply and with great sincerity so that we can really bring some kind of down-to-earth, practical, compassionate wisdom to our life and to every form of life on this world that seems to be, in this world that seems to be just spinning out of control. And I think this is really our deepest intention. We all tell ourselves, I'm going because, but underneath all of that becauseness, I think there's a deep intention. And I think bringing this benefit to the world through ourselves is certainly one of our deepest intentions. And we confirm this in our practice. Every morning when we chant the robe verse, we chant a great robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. We're dedicating ourselves, not just to the robe, but as the robe of liberation, as the formless field of benefaction. We put it on our head. We remind ourselves, this is what our life is about. We want to be the great robe of liberation. We want to be the formless field of benefaction, and we are. And we have to find out how that's true. And the same is true after the Dharma talk and with the four great vows we chant. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. I think this is our deepest intention. And this is why we come here, no matter what we tell ourselves. So, and we want to encourage that in ourselves, and we want to encourage that in each other. So whenever I give a talk, for example, my hope is to encourage all of us, myself included, because I need encouragement too, to nourish this deepest intention so that our true, whole, original, and beautiful self can emerge. And I don't mean just at some point in our life. I mean right here in this session, right here today. I think one of the easiest ways to say it is that this is our deepest intention because we're all good people. And I read your registration forms and no one wrote down in the comments that they were a bad person. So I feel fairly certain that we're all good people here. So we all know what it's like to encourage other people, to encourage life. And it's wonderful. When we encourage someone, it means that we touch their heart in a way that ignites their heart with its own flame. You know, we say something or we do something, and that person's heart jumps a little bit, but not with our flame. It jumps alive with its own flame. And that's what's so important. It's right there in the word from the French, in and courage. There's the heart right there. And in Zen, one of the ways that we encourage people, or maybe the way we encourage people, it means to become one with the heart of the person who's right in front of you, so that there's no me doing something for someone else that we call you or them. It's just when there's real encouragement, there's just one heart, just one shared heart, and it's completely alive. And it's not determined by whether or not, whether or not we're in the room with someone. That doesn't limit it. It may be we're in the room with someone, but we may not be. It may not even be whether we're living in the same time period. Just think about all the ancestors who practiced, that kept this practice warm and taught, and the stories told about them, and their sincere and determined practice that kept the idea that a human being could wake up alive. Think about how encouraging those ancestors of ours have been to us. Without them, I don't know that we would be here. They didn't just practice for themselves. The fact that they practiced entered our heart and made us realize maybe something can be done in this life too. So I think we have a phrase in Zen, it takes a Buddha and a Buddha. And I think that it really does take a Buddha and a Buddha to live as we were meant to live this life, and also to be lived by life. And this is a phrase my teacher used to use, life lives you, and it does. And sometimes it lives us in very wonderful ways, and sometimes it just grinds us down. And one of the things that we wake up to when we encourage others or when we feel encouraged is that we don't have to be alone. We actually can't be alone. And that there is nothing but Buddhas all around us. So in our Zen practice, we express this deepest intention in how we practice. And we do everything in a very simple and very direct way. And it brings about this kind of meeting, this kind of meeting of hearts, this meeting of oneness. Because when a heart comes to heart, life comes to life. It's really that simple. You know what it feels like when you're just lost in your own misery and then suddenly someone shows you in some way, I see you. And I like what I see. It's a good thing. And it doesn't matter whether we're encouraged or encouraging another person, or whether we bring that meeting about heart to heart with maybe the sound of the bird. We meet the sound of the bird completely. Or maybe something in our inner world. It could be anything. Because life has this tendency to want to bring itself to life. In the Buddha Dharma, this meeting that I'm talking about, this coming together as one, I'm using the words heart to heart, this is how the Dharma teaches, and this is how the Dharma, that also means reality, and the world comes alive for us. It comes alive for us through this meeting that I'm talking about. And it's also how we meet ourselves. When our ancestor Tozan Zenji said, when you understand self that includes everything, you have your true way. He was pointing to this. Self that includes everything. Very important. My teacher used to say, everything you encounter is the self. And I admit that for a long time, it was a nice idea, but I didn't really know how to take that in. But through practice and through the constant encouragement that practice brings about, and through being with a Buddha and a Buddha, year in, day out, all the time, through being encouraged by the ancestors who gave us their teachings through our literature and through the practice, at some point I knew that what Roshi said was true, that everything I encountered was myself. So when I think about talks like this one for Sesshin, I go to the same place and I ask myself the very same question that I ask when I'm writing a poem, because I'm a poet, so what I do. And the question is, what is the most important thing? What is the most important thing? And it's a question that I hope you'll very sincerely take with you into your practice in the way that I want to talk about it. What is the most important thing doesn't mean what's the most important thing I need to do in order to get something or gain something or accomplish something. It's the kind of question that we ask very quietly, very subtly, with a kind of pure-hearted spirit. Very, very kind of innocent question that we let float down through our bodies and through our minds. What is the most important thing? From top to bottom, no matter what we're doing, what is it? Right here. Yes, there's all kinds of stimuli, there's all kinds of demands going on in our lives. What is the most important thing? To try to maintain contact with that, to try to develop that. Because our lives are short, as we know. And the Irish adage is, of course, life is short, but the days are long. And some days are really long. Yes, you know. And they can be very confusing. Our life can really confuse us with all the demands and the pushing and pulling that happens on a daily basis. And we can spend years spinning in circles. But asking this question, what is the most important thing? And asking it in the spirit that I'm thinking about, right? Just quietly let it float down, can really cut through that confusion pretty quickly if we give ourselves the gift of a good question. In Zen, the way we ask that question is we say, who am I, really? Who am I isn't the end of the question. Who am I, really? Right. Who am I? We can still kind of slide around. The ego says, oh, I know. But who am I, really? Or we can ask, what brings life to life right now? Right? What is the most important thing? And when we answer that with our lives, that's actualizing the fundamental point, which we studied in our study retreat last autumn. When one of my favorite poets, William Carlos Williams, when he was speaking about his life as a poet, he pointed to this actualization that I'm speaking about in the act of composing the poem. When he said, the poet thinks with the poem, and that in itself is the profundity. The poet thinks with the poem, and that in itself is the profundity. And when he says thinks, he doesn't mean the poet kind of gets some big conceptualization and wonderful idea, and now he's going to plan to write this great poem about some subject. That's not what he's talking about. Thinks means full engagement. So the poet fully engaged with the poem, that in itself is the profundity. That full engagement. And that's how that question emerges, and it's how the question gets replied to as well. The profundity is found in the act itself. It's not something that happens outside of a poet when the poet is writing. And when the poet is fully engaged in composition, in that moment, she becomes real to herself. And the world of the poem becomes real to the poet. And if the poet is able to stay completely real to herself, and the world of the poem is able to stay completely real in that moment to that person writing, then there's a chance that someone reading it centuries later will be able to enter that world too, because of the full engagement in the act of composition. And this is exactly, now I want to make the bridge, this is exactly what Dogen meant when he said that our practice was practice realization. The practice realization is the full engagement in practice, not separate from realization. So it's in the act itself, it's in the doing itself. And we practice that on and on here with Sesshin. So it's in how we do what we do. I think that I think a very good way for us to ask the question of what is the most important thing here at Sesshin is to change the language a little bit and just ask, what is my inmost request? Everyone has an inmost request, but what is my inmost request? And it's not a question that we ask again in some kind of intellectual way. We don't ask it just with the mind or just in some conceptual way and have some fancy ideas and come up with a great version of ourself that pleases our ego. This is an embodied practice. Zen is an embodied practice. So we go to the body, and we know that this is our question. What is my inmost request? And beyond any words, because we set ourselves in that direction, we know that's what we want to know. Beyond any words, we just quietly allow ourselves to be touched by that inmost request, because we've called it into being. We've asked it to show its face, to help us. And so we use words, we let it rise up beyond words, and then we wait, knowing we have a practice that's called full engagement. You know, full engagement is a way that I could translate to shikantaza, shikan. Shikan means full engagement, 100% complete all the way through. And I think if we look at ourselves, not just honestly, but very deeply, beyond all the reasons that we think brought us here, I think you'll find that it's our inmost request that has brought you to Zen practice. something you may not even have been able to identify in some way. But something wants you to do this, because this is not easy to do. Something profound wants you to do it. So we can meet our inmost request right here at this retreat. We can meet it. And even to meet it a little bit, even to touch it and be touched by it a little bit, is very, very good. So I hope you'll carry that possibility with you, to know I can actually meet this inmost. It's more than a desire. It's please, please, that my life wants me to have. You know, it exists in the ineffable world. It's not necessarily just a feeling. And so nourishing it is a very subtle and a very delicate matter for us. We don't really reach for it. We don't try to create it. We don't try to make it. We don't try to gain anything. We just quietly allow it to emerge because we've asked it to please come and let us know it as it is. And it's always there. It's always been there. You may have been able to touch some part of it when you were younger. Life teaches us to defend against knowing this kind of thing in ourselves, but it's persistent. It's strong. And beyond any use or purpose that the ego might have, so that you can walk around feeling like you're a good guy, good men and women or something like that, we just make some space for it. And the way we make space for it is called zazen. That's part of what we're doing in zazen. We're making space for our inmost request to come so we can become aware of it and it can help our lives as a loving and very kind of subtle companion. So trying isn't what's needed. Allowing is what's needed. Just allow. You know, remember when you were kids, maybe you got an allowance? So you're trying to give yourself an allowance here. It's a very gentle way. And when it does come, it might be very straightforward, and you can really feel it, and you can really identify it, or it can come with a pretty clever disguise also. Speaking personally in my own life, at some point, my life was going great. Everything seemed perfect on the outside. It couldn't have been better, really. And right down in the middle of me, I felt this big hole. So on the surface, everything was great, but deep down, there was this big hole inside of me. And our inmost request can have a very curious way of appearing, making itself known to you. And in my case, it was this pretty large feeling that something was missing. So I called my friend Diane, who I was very close to, and she was one of Suzuki Roshi's original students. And I told her everything I just told you about my life and this feeling that something was missing. And she said in her own wonderful way, she said, oh honey, it's just time for you to come in out of the cold. And she said that because I had been practicing alone for 10 years. I've been meditating by myself for 10 years. Staying away from groups, I have a sort of, misanthropic part of my personality, but staying away from groups, not wanting anything to do with institutional Zen or anything like that. I practiced deeply every day. I gave myself to my practice, and it all added up to something's missing. And Diane knew it. And so I said to her, what do you mean it's time for me to come in out of the cold? And she said, it's time for you to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So she was calling my bluff. With all those years of practice, 10 years of practice, and I was still holding myself at a distance from my inmost request. And when she said, it's time for you to take refuge, my inmost request burst into tears. And they were tears of acknowledgement and tears of relief, because my inmost request really wanted to get my attention, and so it was so smart that it decided to make me miserable. And that was a very great gift. So I raged to see the Zen master that I knew I wanted to be my teacher. Diane had introduced me to him. many years before. And I went, got an interview with him and went to see him, and I told him everything I just told you, and I said, so, you know, please, would you let me be your student? And he said, no. So I thought, maybe he was distracted, you know. I'll tell him again. So I told him the whole thing all over again. And he listened and smiled and he said, no, it's not going to work out. So I had to really touch some place in me that was very sincere. I showed him my heart. And he accepted me. And in the very next sentence, he said, okay, well, since I'm your teacher, do you have any questions? And I said, yes, I do. And what I said came right from my inmost request. I hadn't planned anything. And I said, so I was surprised when I heard myself say, and I said, will you please teach me how to bow? And because my inmost request had been given a voice, finally, the bow that it asked about wasn't just with my body. I wanted to bow. Every part of me wanted to bow. That means let go of all the distance that I had been carrying between me and who and what I really was. It was time. So those tears, when Diane said it, my request to bow, that's inmost request. That's what I'm talking about. So our practice gives us a lot of opportunities to nourish and to cultivate our inmost request. We can cultivate it in the way we stand. Can you feel it when you stand? We can cultivate it in the way we hold our hands in shashu. When you're walking during the practice, try just holding your hands in shashu instead of swinging your arms. See what happens when you keep yourself together consciously. Certainly, we can nourish it in the way we gusho. Do we really acknowledge, do we really gusho when we do it, or is it just kind of a machine, you know, banging? Well, I have to do it because they told me to do it. There may be something in the way you bring your hands together that brings all of you together with your inmost request. We can nourish it and cultivate it in the way we walk up to the barn, certainly in the way we eat our meals at Oryoki. All of these activities are opportunities for us to meet and nourish and cultivate our relationship to our inmost request. And it's very subtle, but by practicing in a loving and also a disciplined way. And the discipline is no small part of this. Because it's the discipline that keeps bringing us closer to ourselves and helps us to continue dropping all that distance away. We just do what we're supposed to do. Rather than, I want to, I don't want to, I don't feel like it, it's no good, he's stupid, why am I here? Just do it. And you give yourself to your discipline. And you've heard me say before, many of you, but Carl Jung, the Swiss analyst, said discipline is obedience to awareness. So you do it in a way that's obedient to your awareness, your growing awareness, that you actually can come closer to your real self. That's an act of love. And then pretty soon, our inmost request starts to permeate everything we do and can right here in this session. And it's the best way for us to answer the question that most people have when session is over, which is, yeah, I feel so good, I feel so happy, so quiet, and I feel so calm, everything's so spacious, but I'm terrified, I'm going to lose all of this as soon as I go home. And the answer is, practice in a way that nourishes that inmost request and allow yourself to establish relationship to it and be guided by it, and it won't just disappear when you go home. Then you won't feel whatever your form of that hole in the middle of your life is. Instead, you'll have a clear direction. You'll have a way to live. And you'll be able to experience your own wholeness. It's a great gift. First, Zen master that I practiced with was Maizumi Roshi, Taizan Maizumi. And He did a translation of Genjo Koan, Dogen's Genjo Koan, Actualizing the Fundamental Point. And in it, there's a phrase that really took me. No creature ever falls short of its own completion. Wherever it stands, it does not fail to cover the ground. No creature, that's us, ever falls short of its own completion. Wherever it stands, it does not fail to cover the ground. That's Inmost Request, embodied, manifesting, right there. We are whole, we are complete, and no matter the conditions of our lives, we cover the ground. That wholeness is known. And that's what happens when we align ourselves with the Inmost Request. And so as we practice in the way that I'm saying, in a very loving way, very soft way, but a very gentle, a very determined way, a very disciplined way, something happens. And what happens is that even though we didn't realize it, a very deep faith and confidence in our real being enters our lives. It's not a faith in, really. It's a faith of, it's a confidence of being. Does that make sense to you? Confidence of being. It's a faith of being. It's life knowing what it's here for and living accordingly. And that comes when Inmost Request and our life comes together. I wish it for all of you. I want it for all of you. And all of you want it for yourselves. That's my guess, because that's why you're here. Beyond any reasons, as I said, you gave yourself. If you ask yourself, what is the most important thing? Never mind ideas of I can do it, I can't do it, it's not convenient, it's a bad time, you know, all of that kind of stuff that we put between ourselves and the thing that most wants to come to life for as many years as we have. And we can do it. So I've mentioned the poetry, so I'm going to end with a poem. This is a poem I love very much. It's by the French poet de Jacques Prévert. And it translates, the title is To Paint the Portrait of a Bird. And like most poems, you know, you can interpret it in many ways, but the way I see this poem now is this is an expression of our inmost request, of our relationship with our inmost request, and the kind of dance of coming to it and being able to touch it and be touched by it. It points to the kind of quiet seeing and the kind of quiet listening and the kind of sensing into the dark, as I said, in that ineffable world that we are, sensing it. It points to the kind of great and allowing care that will help that inmost request come forward so we have a friend. Maybe it's the best way I can say it. A true friend. To paint the portrait of a bird, first paint a cage with an open door. This could be us. We can see ourselves as a cage. But because we have a practice, we should know the door is always open. So first, paint a cage with an open door. Then paint something pretty, something simple, something beautiful, something useful for the bird. Then place the canvas against a tree, in a garden, in a wood, or in a forest. Hide behind the tree, without speaking, without moving. Sometimes the bird comes quickly, but it can just as well spend long years before deciding. Don't get discouraged. Wait. Wait years if necessary. The swiftness or slowness of the coming of the bird has no relationship to the success of the picture. When the bird comes, if it comes, observe the most profound silence. Wait till the bird enters the cage. And when it has entered, gently close the door with a brush. Then, paint out all the bars one by one, taking care not to touch any of the feathers of the bird. Then, paint the portrait of a tree, choosing the most beautiful of its branches for the bird. Paint also the green foliage and the wind's freshness, the dust of the sun, and the noise of insects in summer heat, all the things birds love. And then wait for the bird to decide to sing. If the bird doesn't sing, it's a bad sign. A sign that the painting is bad. But if it sings, it's a good sign. A sign that you can sign. So then, so very gently, you pull out one of the feathers of the bird and you write your name in a corner of the picture. And it's okay, you can do it, you won't hurt the bird, because you and the bird are just one. So we can paint the portrait of a bird. And we start by painting a cage with an open door. Can you hear how delicate that relationship is? How sensitive, how truly sensitive we have to be with this bird that we are, that just wants to sing freely with no bars around it. It's a beautiful poem. Did you like it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's us. We are the bird and we are the painter. And so to paint a portrait of the bird is to paint our life into the world as we truly are. And so we have to touch it at the source. True being is not separate from inmost request. So please cultivate this in your life. So that's seems to be what I wanted to talk about. We have some time for comments or questions. Anyone have anything they'd like to say?
Seems that not only are we the bird and the painter, but we are also our own jailer and our own liberator.
Yes, absolutely. That's right. Yeah, we are the bird, and we are the painter, and we are our own jailer and our own liberator. Absolutely right. If we know that, and I'll talk about that more tomorrow. If we know that, and we know that because we have a practice, there may be a cage, but it's a cage with an open door. We know our direction. We have our direction, and we have a way to go forward to it. We're in it. But if we just think it's a cage, it's not a good situation, to say the least. When we look at what's going on in the world right now, we can think it's locked down. We can think it's over. It's caged in. There's no hope. There's no chance. There's nothing that really can be done. And everything seems to confirm it. But we have a practice. And we have a way. And we don't know in the end that will not be the liberating factor in this difficult situation that we have created. And so we continue, and it's important that we continue. As Tozan Zenji said, when you understand self that includes everything, you have your true way. And so we practice knowing everything, everything, everything. I'm going in that direction. Is there a promise? There is no promise. But I'm going in that direction. Because I don't want to go in the other direction. The other direction is a cage without an open door. So we go. Very important. Thank you. Anybody else have a comment? Melanie?
Can you speak about the bad part?
What's the bad part?
Well, when he says that's bad, about the burden.
Yeah, it means that we have still given ourselves a little wiggle room in which we're drowning. Right? It means we haven't fully engaged with our inmost request in a way that will help to bring it to life. Right? So there's still a little bit of room, and that little bit of room, in Zen, it's talked about quite a bit. You know, people are like sitting. They're sitting very fully, very wholly. Everything is going great. And they're just about to actually touch the true self. And the ego pulls them away. Because it still has that power to do it, rather than being able to tumble forward into our real self. So the painting will show that. You know, you can see it. You've heard me say this before, but I don't have magical powers. It's, you know, just part of my training. But I can pretty well see where your mind is at by the way you put your hands together. Some people do this. Some people do this. Some people bow like that. I know whether you're actually giving your life to your life. And you can see it. You know, everybody can see it. You know. So it's that distance that I'm talking about, that Prevere is talking about. You know, when the painting is, quote, bad. Bad means not there 100% yet. Maybe close. But 1% can undo it. That's why, you know, Dogen and, you know, our great ancestors have always expressed the idea we must go all the way through. Whereas he said, we study the self to forget the self. So when we forget the self, then we become intimate with all things. But if we still hold on to that idea of the separate self, we can't fully realize. And the bird stays in the cage. Yeah? Right? Yeah. Okay. Hi, Judith. Buenos dias. ¿Cómo estás?
Muchas gracias.
Sí, por todos.
Struck as you were talking about my own awareness of all of the bad painting I've done in my life. Mm-hmm. And that awareness at the time that I'm not, that first becomes the impetus that I'm not real with myself. Mm-hmm. And not being able to verbalize it, I now know when I first saw it. Mm-hmm. But just the awareness that was there. Mm-hmm. And the push that it began making toward trying to be real. Mm-hmm. And even after years of practice, getting and still making, there were better paintings, but there were still bad paintings. Mm-hmm. In this way. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking to myself, what's it going to take? What's life going to have to do to me for me to wake up? Mm-hmm. Because I was... Sometimes I think 99% there, mm-hmm. not 100%. Mm-hmm. And it would just redouble the effort to try, mm-hmm. until life delivered the mm-hmm. blows, mm-hmm. that knocked me down. Foreign is what it felt like. That I gave up trying. Mm-hmm. And yet there was no other thing to do but give the effort that wasn't giving effort. Mm-hmm. So... in some ways, for me, I now believe that shift was the distinction you made of I was had faith in, but this became faith of, because I had to give it all up to this thing that's life, and let that somehow manifest through me in whatever way life's plan was, not my plan. because I was just always trying to paint with my plan. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what happens is that we see a ball of yarn and we decide, oh, I know a good way to take care of that. I'll just tie it in a knot. So we just keep tying a ball of yarn that's in a knot and expect it at some point it's just going to work. It's all going to work out. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. Would life be ludicrous?
Yeah. But you know what Katagiri used to say? I told you this. If you have a knotted ball of yarn, don't pull on the strands. Just hold it lightly in your hand and give it a little shake. And the yarn starts to loosen itself. That's called allowing, not trying. There's a difference between effort and trying. Right? Trying has a very specific intention. Effort means I just give myself. And I don't know. A bit. Oh, we have to stop. Yeah.
Oh, no, I wasn't signaling stop.
No, she is.
Oh, is she?
The Dalai Lama. Okay, we have 1 minute?
Oh, do we?
Do
okay.
We?
We have 2 minutes.
Yeah. I find especially 10 or 20 minutes prior to Dokusan that it's very, very difficult to come up with a question. And I like what the poet said about waiting maybe years, mm-hmm. but I don't feel like I have that. Possibility here. Where can I find my inmost request in a hurry?
Be retreats alone without any help.
Thank you.